now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 5th day of April, 2023. We're ready for arguments in our first case in the matter of the welfare of the child of ARG and DAS. We'll hear first from appellant's attorney. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning each leg of your argument. You'll have 15 minutes each for primary argument and another 5 minutes for appellant's counsel for rebuttal, should you choose to use it. You may proceed. You are free also to use whichever microphone you prefer. If you want to maintain distance, there's one immediately to your left. The center does raise up or down if you want to use that one. We'll take a moment to allow you to get situated.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Viet Han Winchell, and I represent the appellant. May it please the court, counsel. The district court's ruling to terminate Mr. Swenson's parental rights to his 3-year-old child was unsupported by the facts and evidence presented at trial. We respectfully request this court reverse the district court's decision. A parent's rights should only be terminated for grave and weighty reasons, reasons you will find lacking in the trial court record.
Can I ask you which findings of fact you think are clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. When we're taking the central tenet to any child protection matter is reunification. With that, we have a court-ordered case plan. In any case, the expectation is that if a parent follows the case plan successfully, they should be reunified with their child. Here, Mr. Swenson did that very thing. He was successful in completing his case plan and following his case plan, yet his rights were terminated. To give you an example, Your Honors, as part of the case plan, he was to maintain contact with the agency. He did so. Not only to provide updates about himself, but to get updates regarding his child.
Can I interrupt you, Ms. Winchell? I was anxious to hear you answer Judge Riley's question. I'm not sure you have, because the judge did make findings that he had followed the plan despite the ultimate order. And so, at least that's the way I read it. Generally speaking, the court found that he did. So I am curious, too, what specific findings that led to the termination do you think are clearly erroneous, despite the fact that everybody agrees that he completed the case plan?
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess what I was trying to provide as an example is that these findings do not support the termination, and therefore it is abuse of discretion. These findings...
I'm trying to understand your argument. So it's that... You're not quibbling with the findings per se. It's that the conclusions that the judge drew from those findings are where the judge abused his discretion.
Yes, that is in part. So these facts really only lead to one conclusion, and that's for Mr. Swenson to maintain his parental rights and not to terminate them. My apologies. One of the erroneous facts is that regarding the parent-child relationship. The court states that there is not a parent-child bond, or that this child cannot properly bond or attach to his father, when all of the witnesses said the opposite. The parenting supervisor said that there was a positive parent-child relationship. The guardian ad litem said that there was a positive parent-child relationship. And even Mr. Swenson testified regarding his relationship with his child. But yet the court... speculates that this parent-child relationship doesn't exist. There's testimony regarding the child being sad when his father was going to leave at the visits. There's testimony regarding how excited the child was when he got to visit his father. There's also testimony regarding how he wanted to go home with his father, yet somehow the district court stated that there's no parent-child bond, and therefore it was not in the best interest for this child.
Well, for instance, I'm looking at finding 55, which is on page 8 of the order. And the judge says Larry Swenson and Kristen Swenson both testified credibly that they have observed father interact in a positive, appropriate way with Caden. Father plays with Caden, is calm and patient with him. So I do... The findings, the judge did seem to credit the testimony about your client's interactions with his son. And that's scattered throughout.
I agree, Your Honor. But if you take a look at findings 91, the judge says, while Kaden and father have a bond, it does not appear to be a parent-child bond. There's nothing in the record that would support such a finding. And that's a finding that the district court relied on to terminate Mr. Swenson's rights.
Okay, so that would be one of the clearly erroneous findings.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, are there others that you think are clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. The court's reliance on Mr. Swenson's past conduct and history to support the termination. Case law states that the district court must take a look at the current conditions at the time of the trial in order to determine whether or not those conditions can be addressed in the reasonably foreseeable future.
I think the judge did that. My reading of that is the judge acknowledged that your client had been sober since he was in custody in March of 2022, but that only 4 days of sobriety, which occurred right before the trial, were in a situation where he wasn't either in jail, in inpatient treatment, or in a sober halfway house. That those were the only 4 days, and given your client's lengthy history of meth use, the judge needed to see more.
And
unstructured sobriety.
The agency's expert, the parenting evaluator, didn't discount those 8 months of sobriety. The evaluator didn't say, well, those don't count because it was in a structured setting.
But the judge didn't apparently necessarily agree with the that evaluator, because the judge wanted to see more sober time in an unstructured setting.
And that's where Mr. Swenson was at a complete disadvantage here, Your Honors. He started this case with only had a third of the normal time to be addressing these case plans.
So this is the problem I have with that argument. The problem is that he had been not in custody from the time he was adjudicated the child's father, which I think it was May of the year before. And he had been living with and taking care of the child up until the time he went back into custody. And so during that whole time, he admitted that he was using meth. He was caring for the son while using meth. He says it was okay because he didn't use in front of the child. So he had all those months to get sober, and then it was by his own actions that he goes back into custody in March of 22. So I think the judge looked at that timeline and took that into account in making the decision.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, what then is the point of having the case plan? What then is the point of all these requirements in the statutes to allow a parent to, in essence, rehabilitate when the court is going to terminate their rights anyway? There's no reason for those statutes. There's no reason for guardian ad litem. There's no reason for experts. If the parent takes the initiative, takes those proactive steps in order to take advantage of those services, get themselves better, get them to a place where they should be able to parent their child like in this situation, except the district court said, sorry, we're going to terminate your rights anyway.
Of course, he was also I don't know if I'd put it this way, receiving services from the Department of Corrections because he was on paper.
I'm sorry?
He was on paper, and so he had a probation or parole officer who checked up on him regularly during that time, too. And he knew that he was supposed to not use, stay sober, all of those sorts of things during that period also. Now, that's not a case plan per se with regard to parenting, but he knew what the expectations were.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, with the child protection, it's in essence giving him a chance to do the right thing. He's done the right thing, yet he's going to get the rug pulled from out from under him anyway.
Ms. Winchell, did your client, I didn't see it in the record, at any time ask the court to continue the TPR, and essentially to delay the permanency as it's allowed to do in if it makes findings of in the child's best interest, in order to allow your client to have additional time of sobriety? Was there ever any talk about that, or was it any formal request, or perhaps even an informal request, perhaps even leading up to the TPR trial, because it did seem rather compressed when he got released to the time of trial, and a lot of things perhaps were happening in a short period?
In all honesty, Your Honor, I don't recall that there was a specific request, but by the time that this case started, they were already past the permanency progress review stage of it.
But would you agree that can be extended under the statute for good cause or best interest of the child, of course? And I just was curious if anybody, by assuming the county hadn't, but if your client had made that request.
I don't recall about my client, Your Honor, but I know that at the trial, the guardian ad litem did make two recommendations. One, specifically related to what you're stating, is that the guardian ad litem felt that a four-month extension in order to allow Mr. Swenson to show that sobriety and stability for another 4 months. That was one of the recommendations that the guardian ad litem made. But also, the guardian ad litem did not recommend an unqualified termination. Rather, the other option that she recommended to the court was to, if there was a termination, that there should be a contact agreement between Mr. Swenson and the child, again showing that there is that parent-child bond that was important to the guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem is the one that is charged with the task to make recommendations as it relates to the best interests of the child, yet the district court doesn't follow those recommendations. And that is an abuse of discretion. Again, there's
Can I
no...
ask a slightly different question regarding the sobriety issue. Would you agree that it's relevant to a judge in any TPR case to consider the history preceding the filing of the petition? Because obviously Human Services doesn't know when one begins using drugs, and it usually comes to their attention because of something that follows. So what, if anything, is unique in your mind as a matter of law as we review whether there's an abuse of discretion by the fact that there's no evidence from at least from the time he was in custody in this recent CHIPS TPR phase versus the importance of still considering the history? What's wrong with that, in other words, or what's the abuse of discretion?
There's no doubt that Mr. Swenson's history and past conduct is partly what brought this case to child protection. But again, what case law requires the district court to review is evidence that addresses those conditions. I'm sorry. That requires the court to take a look at the conditions at the time of the hearing and to determine whether the parent can appropriately parent in the reasonably foreseeable future. That was not the case in this situation. Mr. Swenson had addressed all those issues. He went to inpatient. He went to outpatient. He successfully graduated. His counselor supported him. His probation officer supported him. And both found that his effort was genuine, which from the record, you can see that there was a genuine effort and a genuine change. And so what the district court needed to take into account is that change, not just the fact that he has a history of use, because every parent coming into child protection has some sort of history. That's the reason why the case is there. But what matters is how they address it and what the condition is at the time of trial in order for the court to determine what the future of this child is. The court got it wrong here. Mr. Swenson did everything and continues to do everything to be that good parent So his rights should not have been terminated. It simply wasn't in the best interest of this child for his father's rights to be terminated. And in looking at the child protection case in this situation, the court also has to take a look at whether the agency made reasonable efforts under the circumstances. We knew that Mr. Swenson was under the gun. He had a very short amount of time, yet he still completed everything that he was asked to do. And in that short amount of time, did the agency provide reasonable efforts? No. They delayed everything from the get-go. The very first example that you'll see is that the agency waited 20 days to get in contact with him for the first time, even though he was in custody. Then they wait another 30 days to meet with him in person at his insistence. And one of the two most important things regarding the delay is that the agency purposefully delayed the parenting assessment until September. That's a month before trial. And then delayed the visits with his child. I see that my time is running out, Your Honors. I do wanted to address very quickly the transfer of custody petition. There was one finding related to the transfer of custody, and
Counsel,
that was
why
that.
Why don't we have you do that on rebuttal?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Would you state your name for the record before you begin, please?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Amy Capelli. I am an assistant Chisago County attorney, and I represent the respondent, Chisago County Health and Human Services, in this matter.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Chisago County Health and Human Services asks this court to affirm the district court's termination of appellant's parental rights and the dismissal of appellant's alternative petition to transfer custody. As this court knows, the appellate court may affirm the district court's termination of parental rights if one statutory basis for termination has been proved by clear and convincing evidence.
Let me tell you that I am not impressed with the fourth statutory basis.
The predatory offender registry
basis?
Yes,
and are you aware that SBG, the case where this court found that was okay, was argued in front of the Supreme Court yesterday?
I did listen to the oral argument. I didn't realize it was yesterday, Your Honor.
Or recently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well then I can certainly move on from that, but I do want to just acknowledge that the appellant did concede that the county had proved that statutory basis. And I do want to just...
I think that's your strongest basis?
I think that the strongest basis is actually 260C.301.
I'm not that good anymore. You can just state...
Neglect of parental duties, I believe, is how the judge... termed it, which is the substantial failure to comply with the duties imposed upon the parent-child relationship.
But then how do you respond to father's attorney that dad did everything once the TPR, even before it was filed?
Correct. And I think past history is relevant, but I think what makes this case unique is that as the court indicated, due to the appellant's own actions, he was incarcerated for a long time for the majority of the child protection case, and then was required by the Department of Corrections to be discharged to the very structured sober living facility upon his discharge from jail.
But Ms. Capelli, I mean, isn't the reason he's incarcerated is the reason for the CHIPS because of the drug use? So in other words, is it really relevant in the sense he was incarcerated so much as he was receiving treatment. So I'm assuming that fact, whether he was in, if everything was the same except he wasn't on probation, but he's chemically dependent, I suspect, but the recommendation and the agency would have been more directly involved in placing him in a primary treatment and an aftercare. So isn't really that kind of mirror all the TPR cases we see where chemically dependent, or CHIPS, I should say, occurs?
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't know what other services, had we not had this incarceration cloud hanging over this case, what other services besides getting a chemical use assessment, getting treatment, providing treatment, following up with treatment providers while in a halfway house. I don't know what other services could have addressed.
Let me ask you this, because it seems like one of the important considerations in this case is whether the conditions that led to the child protection proceeding were likely to continue for a prolonged and indefinite period of time. Because although history is relevant, case law is quite clear that we are very cautious in reviewing termination orders, and the appellate courts are willing to reverse them if the district court hasn't made a finding and must make a finding that the conditions are likely to continue for a prolonged and indefinite period of time. Did the district court make such a finding here?
I do know that the district court made a finding that it was, if I just may turn to the order, Your Honor. Finding number 74, that father would not be able to care appropriately for the ongoing physical, mental, and or emotional needs of the child in the foreseeable future.
Okay.
And I think in trying to answer your questions, what I was going to say that makes this case unique is that four-day period before the trial where the appellant was out of custody. You know, in most cases, we do have a demonstrated period of time where a parent has either been successful or been unsuccessful.
I just looked at a case, an unpublished case of this court, in which we did reverse, even though the judge made a finding that conditions would continue for a prolonged, definite period of time, and we compared the circumstances there to other cases where we said, no, termination is fine. There's no reason to believe anything's going to change. In that case, the mother had done all of her CD treatment, and she was in structured housing looking for an apartment. So here, he's completed all his CD treatment. There's no indication that he's used for a significant number of months. But his housing situation was sort of undetermined at that time, so that might be one distinction.
That's correct. I did read that case that you're referring to, Your Honor, as well. And I think what is slightly different
So if you've read that case, and you, I think it, well, I hate to say it does a nice job of summarizing the facts in others' cases, what distinguishes, why isn't this case like the mother in that case, who before her default did nothing? Then she was defaulted, we reversed it, and she had then all this extra time to get her act together. And she did all of her treatment, she was sober, she was looking for jobs. And the witnesses were in there saying, she's done everything, she could probably do this. And it seems like this is very familiar. The only one thing that stands out to me is, well, like, what's his housing situation? So could you tell us what those findings say about that?
Yes, the district court did make a finding regarding housing, and what the district court looked at in making that finding was that prior to appellant's incarceration, he had been residing with his father,
right,
and he had been actively using in the home of his father. And so the district court said, you know, that might be appellant's plan, but it's not going to be a plan that is in the best
interest
of the
child. But
he hadn't
done treatment at that point, had he?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And I agree. He was using, and there's looks like evidence that he was caring for the child while under the influence of methamphetamine. But at that point, had he done all of the treatment?
In the 2021 time period?
Yeah.
Well, the record indicates that he had been ordered to outpatient treatment and then failed to comply with that, did inpatient treatment, then went from inpatient treatment to sober living, which I think is very relevant in this case, and this was going to be the next thing I pointed to answer your question, which is what Mr. Swenson, or what the appellant testified to, is that he was discharged to sober living while under DOC supervision the first time in December of 2021. And we know by February of 2022, so 2 to 3 months at the most, he's already again using methamphetamine. And then when Child Protection became involved, he did test positive for methamphetamine and then bolted, and Child Protection took custody of this
All right,
child.
But then what about the facts leading up to trial? How long had he been sober before trial?
And that was my next thing, Your Honor. So, yes, he had been sober since he was taken into custody which was, I believe, in early March of 2022.
Was it 8 months, 6 months?
I believe it was 7+, okay. Not eight.
And of that 7+, how much of that time was he not in custody, like corrective custody?
Not in jail?
Yes.
Or, okay. He was discharged from the jail in July of 2022, directly to that structured living facility where he was getting 30 hours of treatment per week in the first phase, and then gradually stepping down in the hours of treatment.
So how many months before trial was he demonstrating sobriety while in a structured living setting, not in jail?
Three months.
Okay.
And then the 4 days outside of a facility altogether.
All right. So really in terms of comparing, and I know these other cases are unpublished, but we need to sort of use our collective judicial knowledge and say, how does this case look compared to others? The difference here is his period of demonstrated sobriety outside of a correctional facility is really only about 3 months.
Correct.
And not to take anything away from that, because that's important, but other cases, I think we had a longer period of sobriety, and it was not in a correctional setting.
Correct, and I think that's what makes this case really unique, and I think it makes it really difficult in some ways, because we want to, as humans, look at appellant and say, you've done this, you've done your case plan, we're happy that you're sober, but our problem is we need to have demonstrated sobriety and stability in the community such that it would be in the child's best interest to be with his father.
On that point, Ms. Capelli, isn't the real issue here, the reason he only had the 4 days or the 3 months in a structured, is because the agency filed TPR almost immediately from his release from jail or soon thereafter, so, and actually sought to be relieved of reasonable services. So in all the cases, at least when I was on the trial court, you're right, you'd have probably that year, your typical year, before a TPR is even filed, or at least it might be filed by the end of the year, so you start. And there'd be treatment, and then there'd be failures, and then there'd be retreatment, and there'd be failures, that sort of a scenario. But here, the agency filed TPR right away, and he had just completed his jail treatment program and just starting the aftercare. So isn't the real issue, and this is why I asked Father's Counsel the same question, why was there such a rush instead of allowing him the opportunity to demonstrate sobriety? And that's why it seems like all the testimony was, if you look at the testimony, you think, well, this is going to be dismissed. Everything was flowery. He'd done the case plan. You even had a guardian ad litem who has positive things to say and so forth. So isn't that really the unique fact here, is he just had no time?
I think that's another unique fact. But what we have to do when we're looking at the best interest of the child is look at how long has this child been in out-of-home placement. And we know that as 3 years old, we have to take into account his prior out-of-home placement time. And so by the time the agency filed our child protection petition, he was out of home already for 206 days. So we actually filed the TPR, I think, shortly after the 335-day requirement that is in statute.
But isn't that given no greater weight than the parental right? And so you do have to balance that, but he wasn't involved to any significant degree with the first 206 days. He didn't even know his father at the beginning. So don't just, and that's the reason that you have that extension for another 6 months. And it just seemed here that seemed like the reasonable thing to do, to see if father, before terminating his rights, has the ability to, or the opportunity to demonstrate.
And I think at the time the agency filed the petition, it was really unknown how long he would be in the sober living facility, and if he ever would be in a position to have the child returned to him within even that extended time period. And of course, I know that the court's not persuaded by this, but we also did have the predatory offender registration requirement as well. And I know the appellant spent a lot of time talking about reasonable efforts, and since the court's not persuaded by the predatory offender registration piece of this, I'm not going to talk too much about asking to be
relieved. I do have a question. So Ms. Winchell pointed to finding 91, where the court made the finding that father and son have a bond, but it doesn't appear to be a parent-child bond.
Yes.
I was curious what factual or record support there was for that finding.
Yes. If the court looks at the testimony of Ashley Steak, who was the parenting aide employed by Chisago County, who observed the visits and by all accounts had the most time with this child, she testified that, yes, she believed there was a bond, but she testified that she did not believe, based on her experience and training and what she was seeing, that it was a secure attachment. So not the type of attachment where this child would rely on his parent to meet his needs. And I think that is what the district court used in making that finding, that it's not a parent-child bond. They're connected, clearly, but it wasn't that type of a bond. And ultimately, the district court determined that the child's interest in stability, a sober caregiver, outweighed any interest in preserving that bond.
And I'm going to ask a quick question before your time is up. It does relate to the predator offender status, because the social worker and I believe the parenting assessor seemed to have the belief that because of that status, he needed to have parenting time 100%, I think it was the quote, supervised. That seems like a misstatement of the law. I'm not aware of any law that would require that. Can you?
I think what the social worker was referring to was the threatened sexual abuse provision of the child protection maltreatment guidelines. So any time that Mr. Swenson would be, or appellant, I'm sorry, would be alone with his child under child protection guidelines, it would be considered threatened sexual abuse. So in order for him to have the child, he would have to have someone supervising to avoid having that report made to child protection, opening another investigation, and child protection continually being involved in this child's life. And I see I have 5 seconds left, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge Larkin, while Ms. Wenchel is approaching the podium, may I say something?
You sure may.
You both did really great jobs on your briefs and your arguments mm-hmm. today. They were really, really helpful to the court. I'll speak for this judge. I'll speak for the court.
For the whole panel. Go ahead, please.
May it please the court. Again, my name is Viet Han Wenchel on behalf of the appellant. Your Honors had asked about Ms. Capelli about discounting isn't the right word, but ignoring the predatory offender status. What is the strongest basis, statutory basis in this case? There isn't one. The other statutes that are cited, when you take a look at the findings, there is no clear and convincing evidence to prove any one of those factors. As Judge, I apologize, is it Slater?
Sleater.
Stated, in essence, what brought this case to child protection is the chemical use. When we take a look at that, when we narrow in that focus, the case plan, everything in the case plan addressed chemical use. Mr. Swenson addressed his chemical use, and he succeeded in addressing those conditions. But in addition to that, Your Honor, when you take a look at the case plan and what seems to be different for Mr. Swenson and even his testimony is that there was a mental health component to it. He was able to address his grief. He himself felt a difference in this treatment versus before. One of your honors had mentioned that this, unfortunately, this is what happens with use, chemical use, is that people fail, but they pick back up and they keep trying. And because of the timelines, unfortunately for Mr. Swenson, he didn't have that time, but with the little time that he did, he was successful. And it was clear, even comparing the testimony from the history, that he was able to do so.
Let's talk about the alternative TLC petition.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a question. Reading between the lines, maybe I'm wrong about this. Child had two half-siblings, and maybe one of them had aged out. I'm not sure, but it looked like mother was working towards reunification with the other half-sibling. The department wanted the two half-siblings to be together, but if one's going to be reunited with mother and mother's rights were terminated, and then father's sister said, I'm interested in adopting this child, father's child. And I'm not saying, I don't know how we're going to go reach, what decision we're going to reach, but sister could still file a petition to adopt if there was a TPR, right?
Ultimately, yes, Your Honor. So the point behind filing the transfer of custody, I think the court could understand, is that it was an alternative permanency option because we knew that timeline was short, and if the court was not going to agree with reunification, there needed to be some other option other than the termination, which is why the transfer of custody was filed. Unfortunately, the prospective adoptive parents at that time dropped out. And that was shortly before the trial, which is why we made the request on the first day of trial to make an amendment. And then, unfortunately, that was dismissed. And the only reason was because the judge stated that the proposed custodian was not a foster care license. And there's nothing in rules, nothing in statutes that would support that finding. That alternative petition would have potentially been a good option and in the best interest of the child if truly the court said, you've run out of time, we gotta figure out permanency for this child. That would have been the best option for Mr. Swenson's child. Because not only does that take into account the guardian ad litem's recommendation as to keeping that parent-child bond, but then it allows that additional time even for the agency's expert who expected a follow-up and more time to review and determine any other factors in that sense. Your Honors, also, even though Mr. Swenson certainly has a history of the chemical use, what you also see in his, specifically his outpatient, yes, it was a structured environment, but it was a step down. He started with 30 hours of outpatient care, and then after that he graduated to the 15 hours to the 9 hours. Those extra hours were on him to be able to schedule group sessions, individual therapy, get a job, and he did actually secure a job. So while he lived in a structured setting, he was out in the community, and he did not fail with his drug testing. He remained sober. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. We'll have our decision out to you within the expedited time frame required under our rules. Thank you.